The great Arundhati Roy's new novel about today's India explores both great beauty and great terror.
If you cannot write about love with the same intimacy with which you write about violence, then you fail because they both exist.
We talk with Arundhati Roy about the Ministry of Utmost Happiness. Then a novel about a mermaid, a merchant, and a madam set in 18th century London.
Yes, I was really interested in these myths of mermaids, particularly because they seem to be very closely aligned with myths, with stories about scarlet women, that a mermaid in our traditional understanding is kind of dangerous, this dangerous lone woman who's out there by herself. She has the power to draw men to her, to do things, to do what she wants.
That's Imogen Hermes Gower. We talk with her about her acclaimed debut novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Arundhati Roy's new novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, takes the reader on a journey across the Indian subcontinent, from the cramped neighborhoods of Old Delhi to the mountains of Kashmir. It's a window into today's India, headed by Narendra Modi, an India, Roy says, that is descending into fascism. Anti-Muslim pogroms are on the rise. Young Muslim girls are being raped and killed. And other marginalized groups like the Dalits are also the targets of violence. Arundhati Roy says what's happening in India is poised to become a danger to the world. Yet her novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, is a work of great beauty and even hope. Her main protagonist, transgender and Muslim, is a real force of love who creates a kind of utopian community in a cemetery in the middle of New Delhi. Beautifully written with compelling characters, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness seems to have been created in a white heat of love for India and outrage against injustice. Arundhati Roy won the Man Booker Prize for her previous novel, The God of Small Things, and has authored numerous works of nonfiction. We spoke to her by phone at her hotel in New York City. Well, Arundhati Roy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, thank you.
Now, this book, this wonderful novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, it follows two major stories that ultimately come together. You begin with the story of Anjum, a transgender woman. She leaves home to join a Hijra community. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
This is traditionally seen as a third gender. Is that right?
Yeah, well, as I explain in the book, you know, she moves out of home. She's born as a sort of Shia Muslim in the walled city of Delhi, and she, you know, eventually moves out of home into another home close by called the Khwabga, which means in Urdu the House of Dreams. And that, I mean, all of them together call themselves hijras, but actually, they each of them belong to many kinds of genders, you know. So the third gender is I suppose, one way of putting it. But as we know now, there are more than three, and some of them are, you know, some of them are men who feel that they're women. Some of them are those who have had surgery. Some have not. Some are just people who like to dress as women but don't think of themselves as hijra. So there's a whole universe of genders in there, and Anjum is one of them. You know, they all call themselves hijras, which is what traditionally they have called themselves. But, sort of feel sad when people just refer to her as a transgender woman. That's not her only identity, you know. And as you see in the book, the fact is that most of the trauma that she goes through is because she's a Muslim, you know, she gets caught up in the massacre in 2002 of Muslims that took place in Gujarat.
Yes.
Because she's a Muslim, and then she escapes because she's a Hijra, and certain Hindus are scared of the curse of Hijras and so on.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to imply that that is her only identity.
Yeah,
she's a wonderful character. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about her. And then I would like to actually ask you about what happened in Gujarat. I'm not sure that all our listeners know that. So tell us more about Anjum.
Well, so Anjum, she's born, you know, soon after independence, in the early 1950s in Delhi, in the old city of Delhi, you know, which is a city which was broken open at the time of partition in 1947, when India was partitioned, and, you know, millions of Muslims fled to Pakistan and millions of Hindus fled to India. And today, Old Delhi is increasingly becoming a ghetto, as are places where Muslims live, because Muslims are in tremendous danger in India today. So Anjum, she actually is born to this very traditional Muslim Shia family who traces its roots to Genghis Khan, actually. And her father is a Hakim, a doctor of herbal medicines, but who prescribes poetry to his patients because he believes poetry can cure ailments like nothing else can. And Anjum, when she leaves home, she becomes one of the best-known hijras of Delhi and very much sought after by, you know, foreign correspondents and NGOs and so on as this sort of slow news day exotic story, you know, and she's absolutely flamboyant and beautiful. And then she, as she grows older, she finds a little girl on the steps of the Jama Masjid who has been abandoned, and she sort of looks for the parents and can't find them, and then brings her home to the Khwabgah. And this little girl is called Zainab. And Zainab is loved by all of them and spoiled by all of them, and she grows up in the Khwabgah with all these many mothers and fathers and in this very fluid situation. And then Zainab falls ill once, and Anjum goes off to Ajmer, to the shrine of a Sufi saint called Khwaja Garib Nawaz, and from there to Gujarat, where she basically lands in February at the time when there's this massacre that took place under the aegis of the Chief Minister of Gujarat at the time, who is today the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, in which basically Hindu mobs massacred Muslims on the streets of Gujarat. You know, the numbers vary from 1,000 to 2,500. They were slaughtered, people were raped, women were burnt alive, and 100,000 were driven from their homes. And that massacre, which people like to call a riot, it was not a riot, it was a pogrom. And Anjum sort of returns from there traumatized by what she has witnessed, watching the old gentleman she had traveled with, Zakir Mia, being killed. And then she cannot continue life as it was in the Khwabgah. So she moves into a graveyard close by. Graveyards, again, in India are now kinds of ghettos where people do live, because graveyards, of course, are only where the Muslim bury their dead, because Hindus cremate their dead and they don't have graveyards. So graveyards are also stigmatized and often the subject of political taunting by the Hindu right. And Anjum lives there as a feral specter, you know, for a long time. And then gradually, as she recovers, she begins to enclose the graves of her relatives, and she builds a little guest house there, which becomes a refuge for all kinds of people who have fallen out of this grid or who have become victims of an increasingly hateful kind of politics that is growing in India while the rest of the world celebrates it as a great democracy.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with the great Indian writer Arundhati Roy about her new novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. Yes, you call this a saffron tide rising in your country, and you actually compare it to Nazism. And when you just said the word pogrom, well, yeah, that's very apt.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a strong statement.
Well, it's a strong statement, but if you look at the, in fact, just day before yesterday, I was reading the main paper of India, the Times of India, which had a huge article about how, you know, one of the most saleable items in India is Hitler. Like, there are all kinds of Hitler or artifacts on sale, and recently a school textbook had Hitler on its cover as one of the world's great heroes. And the RSS, which is an organization called the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, which is an organization to which the Prime Minister Narendra Modi belongs, he's been a worker for the RSS since he was very young. And they actually admire and glorify Hitler. And one of their early ideologues actually says, you know, that the Muslims of India are like the Jews of Germany. One of their earliest ideologues, Munje, actually traveled and met Mussolini, came back very inspired by the black shirts, which is how the RSS trains its cadres now, and there are hundreds of thousands of them. And today, the same things are happening, eugenics, you know, big camps, the ghettoization of Muslims. So I'm not using it lightly or euphemistically.
That is a terrifying statement that you've made.
It is terrifying, and I do feel that, you know, what's going on in India is poised to become a danger to the world.
A danger to the world?
To the world, yes.
Could you say
because
more about
that? Because it's happening undercover, you know? It's happening without people taking note of it. I mean, today, the whole world is talking about the story of an 8-year-old Muslim girl who was kidnapped, held in a temple, repeatedly raped, and then bludgeoned to death. But the point is, of course, 8-year-old girls have been brutalized in this way, and all kinds of girls from all kinds of religions. But the problem is that tens of thousands of people marched in favor of the rapists.
Oh.
You know, this is the problem. You know, that you have all kinds of crime is not the problem, but you do not have popular marches in support of the rape of 8-year-old girls.
Oh, my
goodness. But here you have them.
I thought that there were huge demonstrations to protest the rape.
Yes, but the point is that those demonstrations are, you know, that is in its place and that should happen. But the Hindu Ekta Manch in the place where the rape happened, which the Hindu Ekta Manch means the Hindu United Forum, marches in favor of the rapists.
That's so shocking. You know, this is also going along with very much in your book. I mean, your book talks about this whole rise of Hindu nationalism as well as the fight for Kashmiri independence. And I'd like to talk about that in a minute. But just to stay on this point, another aspect that enters into here is the tremendous corruption in India. And I just wonder, is this something new or is this something that is increasing? And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, corruption is a subject which is far more complicated than people like it to be, you know. So There are forms of corruption which, in fact, in 2000 and I think it was 2010 or 11 when there was that huge anti-corruption movement, which I write about in the book, which was, you know, sort of billed as India's Arab Spring. It was very complicated, you know, because in a way, protests against corruption have always ended up being a way for the middle class to criminalize the poor, you know. So you have corruption of huge corruption by corporates, which is called lobbying and things like that. And then you have a different kind of corruption where a society like India, where 80% of the population is in some way or the other illegal and surviving by, you know, the chaps who sell tea on the street, just pay the local policeman, or all the slums that exist exist by, you know, paying off somebody. But the middle class suddenly begins to crusade against corruption to clean up the city, to clean up their areas, and it becomes a slightly, like this particular anti-corruption movement was completely commandeered by the Hindu right, who then used it to come to power in 2014. So corruption eventually is a manifestation of the huge gap between power and powerlessness in countries like India, you know. And so you will find organizations like the World Bank and the IMF campaigning a lot against corruption because in some ways crony capitalism, where local corporations commandeer the economy and don't leave it open for, you know, foreign capital to come in, is a form of corruption that irks them, you know. But to me, corruption needs to be looked at through a very complicated prism, because some forms of corruption are democratic. They are the ways in which illegal citizens find a foothold in cities and things. You know, the little forms of corruption, which then the middle class seizes upon and tries to clean up. So I have a pretty complicated view on it.
Yes. You know, on the one hand, there's the corruption of, let's say, our President Trump sending his son to deal with business interests in India. And on the other, yes, you talk about, you know, surplus mothers perched like sparrows on the debris of what used to be their homes,
yes,
and sing their surplus children to sleep, which is such a powerful sentence.
Yes. Now, that is also another very, very serious thing, which is going to become even more serious because, you know, today you have a kind of technology which is increasingly making a country like India grow economically, but it's known as jobless growth, right? So, you know, technology is replacing labor in such an immense way that we are generating a kind of surplus population, which is another marker for the arrival of fascism, because you have this what is called not economically productive population, and we know what eventually gets done to it, you know. So if you look at India in the 60s and 70s, you know, even the radical movements, whether it was the radical left or whether it was Gandhian movements, whatever it was, people were talking about the redistribution of land, the redistribution of wealth, of justice. Today, all that has just shriveled into, even the radical movements are just fighting for corporations not to be allowed to take over what land, you know, let's say indigenous people have. But the people who are really poor, who are landless, the big workforce that has been dismantled, it's not even part of a radical discourse anymore, you know. So we are talking about a situation where, you know, when I talk about fascism, I'm not only talking about Hindu majoritarianism. I'm talking about the fact that the Prime Minister can come out on TV at 10 o'clock one night and say that from tomorrow onwards, 80% of the currency is illegal. And you're talking to a population, 80% of whom only function with currency. They don't have cards. They don't have bank accounts. You have such a level of illiteracy, and suddenly you're saying everything shall be digital. People don't know what to do. And so just that one announcement breaks the back of every single citizen, regardless of what mega economic benefit there may or may not be. How can you declare currency, which is a social contract between a government and a citizen, illegal, suddenly, out of the blue, on a whim, without even your own finance minister knowing about it? But it happened, you know? So it's a kind of micro-fascism. It's a kind of fascism which is very peculiar to us. It's not European fascism, you know? It's Indian fascism.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Arundhati Roy about her latest work of fiction, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. It's her first novel since The God of Small Things. Another aspect that, you know, another layer of this, which you also talk about in the book, is caste.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk about that, and also, you know, in the form of your character, a young man who names himself Saddam Hussein.
Well, caste is, of course, it's the ancient and modern motor that has always run Indian society. It is the engine that runs Indian society. And it is an engine which, unfortunately, predominantly, intellectuals, writers, even people of the left and liberals have tried to avoid talking about, you know. But caste is a form of social hierarchy, perhaps the most ancient form of social hierarchy and the most despicable, you know. So today you actually have still a population where there are more than a million people who make their living carrying human shit on their heads. You know, there are still people who are not allowed into spaces because their presence is considered polluting. There are today, I'm just reading today's papers, you know, you see a Dalit is forced to drink urine because he refused to till somebody's field. About 3 weeks ago, to me it was like the story of Saddam, you know, a 16-year-old boy, Dalit boy, who used to be known as untouchable, of course, the caste that used to be known as untouchable, a Dalit boy who loved horses. He wanted a horse. His father tried to tell him, you know, why not get a motorcycle, but he wanted a horse. So he got a horse in Gujarat, and he was beaten to death for having a horse. And this horse, this white horse, like Saddam Hussein's white horse, led his funeral procession, you know. This little girl, Asifa, who was murdered, Muslim girl, of course, her horses came home without her, which is how her parents knew. What is happening with the caste in India is unthinkable. You know, every day you hear in the book, there's a mention of these four Dalit men who were flogged openly on the streets by upper caste people in Gujarat. This happened 2 years ago because they were returning home with the carcass of a cow, which an upper caste farmer had asked them to pick up from his field, which is the same way that Saddam Hussein in the book loses his father. Of course, it's confusing. His name is Saddam Hussein because he disavows Hinduism and takes to Islam and calls himself Saddam Hussein after witnessing the killing of his father by a mob. But those four men who were flogged 2 years ago publicly on the streets, one of them tried to kill himself. And yesterday or day before, they were flogged again because the people who flogged them were released from prison and flogged them again, trying to get them to withdraw the case, you know. So both Dalits and Muslims are being made to live in absolute terror. You know, and for every person that's lynched, for every person that's flogged, you have whole communities too scared to move. Muslims are not just being lynched. You know, their economic base has been devastated. Butcher shops are closed, leather shops are closed, cattle business is shut down. So economically, they are just being strangled by this establishment, which survives by making a population live on a daily diet of hate.
I guess my question is, how did this come about? I mean, I thought India was a democracy. What are the forces that are pushing this kind of fascism?
Well, the thing is that actually there's nothing new. This organization which I spoke to you about, the RSS, to which Modi belongs, it was set up in 1925. And since 1925 has been trying to construct a Hindu majority. Its aim is to change the constitution and say that India is a Hindu country. So it's not that it suddenly happened. It has inexorably been moving towards this place. And we did have to go through this, you know, because of the kind of momentum that has been picking up. And they have been, I mean, whatever it is to their credit, working underground, overground, since 1925 to achieve this moment. And so today we are in a situation where, I mean, next year we have elections. The demonetization and all kinds of other economic moves has broken the spine of the farmers, of small shopkeepers, and so on. So in order to try and regain popularity, the level of religious polarization has just been cranked up hugely. And all the institutions like the judiciary, the army, the police, all these have been penetrated by workers or supporters of the RSS. History books are being rewritten so that in this era of fake news and fake history, today actually there's a huge population in India that believes that this rape of the little girl has been made up, that it's fake news. So everything is fantasy now. The past is fantasy, the present is fantasy, the future is fantasy, science is fantasy, you know?
Yes, and I think we are experiencing some of that very much in our own country here. Before we go, we only have a few minutes left, but I think it's such an important part of the story. The second major story in your book is about a woman named Tilo, very much about the Kashmiri struggle for independence. So just briefly tell us about her, and then tell us about that struggle, because I don't think many Americans know about it, and I know that that's something that you've been very active in supporting for many years.
Well, let me just try and say it as simply as I can. Kashmir is what people refer to as the unfinished business of Pakistan. So Jammu and Kashmir was an independent kingdom, as were about more than 500 at the time of partition, and each of them was asked to choose whether they wanted to be part of India or Pakistan. And Kashmir, which is on the border, the king, it was a Hindu king with a majority Muslim population, and he sort of prevaricated, and it ended up with a kind of militaries of both sides moving in, and Kashmir was partitioned, and part of it with Pakistan, a small part with China, and then the valley of Kashmir, Ladakh, and Jammu are in India. Today, it is the most densely occupied military zone in the world, with more than 500,000 soldiers policing that very small valley. And in 1990, the struggle for independence became militant. And today, the level, I mean, obviously the book talks about it in great detail, but, you know, I mean, just to give you an example, there are mass graves. There's something like 70,000 people killed in the conflict. And, you know, over the last 2 years, the new technique has been to control crowds by firing pellet guns straight into people's eyes. So you have, just over the last 2 years, something like 1,000 or more young people who have been blinded in one or both eyes by this form of crowd control. You know, can you imagine it? Blind young people. Yet we continue to call this a democracy. And when, if they are peaceful, they are fired at. If they are militant, they are fired at. Whatever happens, you know, there is absolutely no sense. I mean, and in this kind of paroxysm of nationalism, people, you know, on the internet are allowed to threaten rape and allowed to spew hatred at anybody who tries to reason or intervene in this situation, saying that this is just not an acceptable way for human beings to behave.
Yes, we've talked a lot about the political context of the book, and I want our listeners to know that this is also a beautifully written book with very compelling characters. It's seemed to me it was very much a novel written in a kind of white heat of both love for India and outrage at the injustice. So I just wonder if, you know, what gives you hope? Do you have hope? What gives you sustenance to write a book of such love and outrage?
Well, honestly, you know, I don't think about... When I write, I don't think about things like countries, and I don't see it as a book about India or Kashmir or caste or any of these issues. You know, I see it as a book about the air, which is full of violence and full of love and full of such. I mean, there are animals in the book. There's, you know, there's a cemetery where the dead people are almost alive. And to me, as a writer, if you cannot write about love with the same intimacy with which you write about violence, then you fail, because they both exist, you know. And I'm not really interested in singling out these things as issues. For me, the whole point is how they are all embroiled with each other, and how do you extract meaning from these things? You know, how do you extract nothing like tinny, idiotic, sort of symbolic hope, but there are the most extraordinary people living in these situations who are still able to be so funny, so loving, and so defiant. And that is, those are the things I write about, because, you know, hope is not something that's reasonable. It's unreasonable. You know, all of us are unreasonable people who will insist on being able to see life in all its complexity, its irrationality, its beauty and its terror.
Well, that's so beautiful. And Arundhati Roy, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your new novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness.
Thank you.
Arundhati Roy, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, is a national bestseller and has been longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, a prize she won for her first novel, The God of Small Things. You can find a link to an excerpt to The Ministry of Utmost Happiness by going to writersvoice.net. Next, a novel about a mermaid, a merchant, and a madam. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Imogen Hermes Gower's acclaimed debut novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, is like traveling back in time. With stunning verisimilitude, she recreates the world of 18th century London, a time poised on the cusp of the modern world, with a wonderful story about a merchant, a madam, and a mermaid. At a time when women's lives are still as constricted as their whalebone corsets, one woman strikes out on her own. Meanwhile, a prosperous merchant finds his life upended when he comes into possession of a mermaid. What happens when these two lives intersect makes for a story about obsession, wonder, and the deepest desires of the heart. Imogen Hermes Gower studied archaeology, anthropology, and art history before going on to work in museums. She began to write small pieces of fiction inspired by the artifacts she worked with and around, and this at least partly led her to writing The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Imogen Hermes Gower, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hello, thank you for having me.
This marvelous novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, I have to say I was absolutely entranced from the very first paragraphs. Because of your language, the amazing verisimilitude, this is almost like a time travel machine into Georgian England. The language cadence, the vocabulary, the syntax is so precisely realized. How were you able to achieve that so well?
I guess I've always been really interested in language and words particularly. So, and actually one of the things that really attracted me to the period was, I guess, a really particular sense of humour and this kind of playful phrasing that I always really enjoyed. So I think while I was researching, I always had like a phrase book to kind of collect all these little pieces of language that I really liked. But I think also because I come from a museums background and I was always trying to understand the world through, or understand people, I guess, through objects and the buildings that they live in and, you know, how they navigate the world physically and in terms of texture, I guess maybe all of that has fed into my understanding of the Georgian period in the book. I think I had an almost curating hat on when I wrote it, that I was very clear about what objects I wanted people to have, kind of what physical experiences. But yeah, maybe I'm just a very physical person and it made sense to me to try and immerse myself in the period in that way.
This was a world very much in transition, both in terms of class, but even I think in your novel, you can see the beginnings of, you know, different ideas that women may have about themselves, maybe just beginning. Talk about the whole transitional nature of this time and how this novel points out those the wrenching from one time to one era to the next.
I think it was just a really extraordinary period in terms of thought and, I guess, tied into that in terms of material culture and empire and industrialism. It's just a point where all across Europe and America, obviously, as well, people start questioning how much of their life is preordained, how much of their life is controlled by God or the situation that they're born into. Do they have a right to challenge that? So in France and in America, that obviously expresses itself eventually through revolution. But in Britain, these same questions are happening. And in Scotland, particularly, you've got the Scottish Enlightenment. People are asking, what qualities are we born with? What rights do we have to change our situation? And this is a particularly male-dominated world of thought, I think, that when people like Mary Wollstonecraft in the 1790s start trying to elbow their way in and say, well, we should also have these rights of self-determination, that they're kind of not included in the gang. But these discussions were already, they were happening, they were taking seed in people's minds. And I guess in Britain, it's not specifically affected by revolution, but there are riots and this idea of mob uprising and violence. There's also a much kind of gentler idea of people being able to make their own fortunes through industry and through trade, that merchants are able to build huge empires of wealth for themselves, and men who have done broadly well in the city might end up as moneylenders to the gentry and make their way in, that there's suddenly this ability to cross over between worlds, to go from the, you know, the working city to the leisured town, to be involved in a completely different world than the one you were born in. I was very interested in that possibility of self-recreation for men. But then for women at the same time, there were so many women in the 1780s who, I think, understood that they lived in a world that was not structured for them, that they were kind of on their own. They had no recourse to what we would call feminism. They had no particular rights themselves. They understood that if they wanted to make their own lot better, they did it on their own. And a lot of these women were businesswomen, but some of them were also actresses and courtesans and sex workers, people who were using their bodies and their public identity to lift themselves out of the situation they had started in. I think almost for women, there seems to be this kind of element that having a clean moral character is maybe sometimes a privilege, is something that if you've fallen on hard times, won't be protected and you won't be safe if you continue to try and be spotless. That lots of these women seem to fall, in quotation marks, for a while and then step back into respectability. So someone like my main character, Angelica Neal, who is a courtesan at the beginning of the book anyway, she's a person on her own in the world. I think she has a great deal of self-respect. She has a very strong character, but she's very self-centered in that she wants to protect herself and do well by herself. She has no vision of every woman in the world being freed, but she wants to do well.
And she's a fascinating character, and really undergoes a kind of transformation in the book. But tell us a little bit about the other protagonist, Mr. Hancock. Now, this is the book The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, and we are speaking with the author, Imogen Hermes Gower. So tell us about Mr. Hancock. As you said, he's a merchant, but how did he come into possession of a mermaid?
So, Mr. Hancock, in my novel, he's a fictional character. He, in 1785, acquires this mermaid, this creepy little wizened baby-looking thing. It's a dead mermaid, stuffed and mounted. And he acquires this. I found a few stories that kind of, from the period, which kind of back up the trajectory of Mr. Hancock's fictional mermaid, that these mermaids were made in Japan, maybe in good faith, maybe not. The Dutch, at that point, are the only Europeans who are allowed into Japan, and they're the people who pick up these, like, weird curiosity freak show mermaids, think that they're the real thing, and bring them back to Europe. So in the 1780s and 90s, these curiosities were being displayed in Europe. And there's quite a few little newspaper cuttings that still survive about them, called the Wonder of Wonders. So Mr. Hancock acquires this mermaid, which his sea captain has got hold of in Macau, from Dutch sailors who have ostensibly brought it from Japan. His sea captain is so excited by the possibility of this mermaid that he ends up selling Mr. Hancock's whole ship, passing up the cargo that he's meant to be collecting and making his way home alone with this mermaid, which he has spent all of Mr. Hancock's money on. So Jonah Hancock in Deptford, he has never left Deptford. He is not an adventurous man. He's not really a visionary man. He suddenly finds himself with this weird curiosity, which he finds that he has to display in order to recoup all of this money that he's lost on it.
And it becomes quite a sensation, and it in fact becomes the ticket to his financial rise in the book. Is it also kind of goes along with the whole idea of the curiosity cabinets and the beginning of the kind of fascination with science?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think you can't get away in this period from, I think, the interest in science, kind of on a serious level, but also as a kind of as entertainment. That there was so much of this, what we'd now call kind of sideshow stuff, being displayed. But for them, it was like a glimpse into the world, that you couldn't, say, go to Australia and see a kangaroo for yourself. The best you can possibly hope is that you are going to see this dead, stuffed, you know, flayed skin of a kangaroo that has been brought back on a boat over 18 months and is now being displayed in the top room of a coffee house or something. That you can't go and check the world yourself. So these little relics, however far-fetched they seem, are the only thing, the only tangible thing that you're ever going to have to show you that these places really exist. And I think particularly that mermaids are so much a part of our kind of cultural consciousness, and they have been for hundreds, if not thousands of years, that when you start going to sea, crossing these huge oceans into the unknown, it almost makes sense that you would expect to find mermaids out there somewhere, that that's something that fits in with our, you know, our internal schema of what mysterious things might be in the world. And I think also maybe this desire that the ocean, you know, the void, which for them would be the sea and for us, I guess, is space, that it's populated by something a bit like us. We want there to be some kind of humanoid presence out there to make us feel less alone. And I think that was partly the fascination with mermaids, was that people so wanted them to exist. It wasn't an unscientific, idiotic assumption that they might be out there. It was a real kind of, almost a hope, I guess.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Imogen Hermes Gower about her novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Now, I hope I'm not giving anything away, and if I am, you can stop me right here. But this dead, little, wizened, desiccated mermaid is not the only one in the book.
No.
So there is a live mermaid who is quite an ambiguous kind of figure. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about her.
Yeah. I think for me, it felt like these two mermaids are the... It's that gulf between what you expect or what you imagine, or I guess what is presented and parceled up almost for entertainment versus something... versus the real thing. So when I was originally looking at this, you know, this little curiosity mermaid, which is in the British Museum, I was thinking a man in the 18th century would want one of these for his cabinet of curiosities, his Wunderkammer. This is the thing that he would be looking to get. What would happen if he sent out for one of these and what he got instead was a real mermaid? And the way that I thought about it was that a real mermaid is still not necessarily your kind of sexy, buxom lady. It's that kind of essence of the sea, of incredible largeness and almost hopelessness, of the sense of your own futility in the face of the vastness of the world, that's kind of, if you were going to have a mermaid be visited upon you as some kind of lesson, that would be the kind of mermaid that would come. And I guess that's what the second mermaid is, that it's very nebulous. I think the people who see it understand it in their own terms of reality. But it brings this kind of, whatever it is, it brings this sense of kind of that hopelessness and longing, and I guess a kind of a sailor's nostalgia, like a yearning for home or a yearning for something that doesn't exist or no longer exists, the kind of feeling of hopeless longing and unachievability. And what would happen when a mermaid... when that kind of feeling comes into this world that I've been speaking about, where people are so busy with self-creation and trying to make themselves the person that they want to be, what happens if that kind of fear and doubt and, I guess, depression starts creeping into their world?
Well, that's a really marvelous, I think, elaboration of the mythical sense that we have of mermaids. I mean, mermaids, after all, you know, lured men to their deaths by filling them with this irresistible longing and desperation.
Yes, I was really interested in these myths of mermaids, particularly because they seem to be very closely aligned with myths, with stories about scarlet women, that a mermaid in our traditional understanding is kind of dangerous, this dangerous lone woman who's out there by herself. She has the power to draw men to her, to do things, to do what she wants, and it doesn't matter if he's got a wife at home or what his responsibilities are. He's kind of helpless in the face of her desirability, her sexuality. And it seemed to me that that kind of runs parallel with these fears about mistresses attracting men's attention outside of the home, drawing them away, breaking up families in this way, that I think it's almost a safer way to talk about infidelity when you have a husband who's going away to sea for months or years. Would you not feel better to think that if he's lured away from you, it's through some kind of supernatural, slightly malevolent presence rather than by just some woman like you? That was the core of Mermaids that I found really interesting in this, while I was writing this novel, which is so kind of concerned with women on the outskirts of society, that it kind of felt like one was a model for the other.
I wanted to ask you about, I saw an interview that you gave, now I'm not sure where it was. It was about the books that you like and that have influenced you. But you talked about a book, Claire Tomalin's biography of the comic actor Dora Jordan, Mrs. Jordan's Profession. And this is something I don't think too many Americans, if any, know about. You said you read it at 14. Tell us about, and you say that if you hadn't read it, you might not have written this book, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Why is that?
Well, I think a lot of people in the UK don't know about Mrs. Jordan either. Claire Tomalin is an extraordinary biographer anyway. I think the first biography I read of hers was Jane Austen, which kind of, I think, really pulls out a lot of the kind of earthiness and waspishness of Jane Austen's humour and the kind of texture of her period. But Mrs. Jordan was, as you say, she was a comic actress. She was originally from Dublin, and she started acting quite young because her father had abandoned her family. So she, as a teenager, took to the stage to try and support her mother and her younger siblings. So again, I guess she's a kind of example of how few opportunities there were for women during this period, that if a man abandons you, you have to start taking jobs, and you have to start taking quite frowned upon jobs like acting in order to make your way. She then, we don't know whether she was in a relationship with the manager of the theatre or whether he raped her or what happened, but she ended up becoming pregnant, being a single mother to his child. She decides to break her contract with him because she no longer wants to work with him, and he charges her £250 for breaching her contract, which is like just an insane sum of money. It's tens of thousands of pounds today. She has no hope of making it. So she runs away to England. She joins a strolling theatre troupe while she's pregnant, which is walking from town to town in the provinces, performing in theatres. And she's eventually spotted and brought to Drury Lane to act for Richard Sheridan there. And she like becomes this comic star. And everybody knows that she has this child out of wedlock. She takes up with some other guy and she has some children with him, and she realises he's never going to marry her either. And she eventually has this affair with the Duke of Clarence, who's one of the sons of George III. And they live together for 20 years, like man and wife. She's often supporting the household through her work. She's so famous. She is a proper celebrity. She is like up there with Mrs. Siddons as one of the most celebrated actors of the day. And Jane Austen went to see her. Frances Burney went to see her. Everybody saw Dora Jordan act. She has 10 children with the Duke of Clarence, and eventually he comes to the realisation that he needs to get married and produce a legitimate heir, because there are all these rules about who royalty can marry and who can't. George III is, you know, a stubborn, draconian kind of a man. And so he decides that the only way that he will get a foreign princess to marry him is if he jettisons his wife or his partner, Mrs. Jordan. So he breaks up with her. She has to leave the home. She's not allowed to see her children, the youngest of whom is 4. She can have no contact with them because she's chosen to go back onto the stage because she has no other means of supporting herself. She chooses to sacrifice her relationship with her children in order to keep paying her way. And she eventually dies in France, like in her late 40s, I think, early 50s. Unable to see her children, penniless, friendless, just totally shut out by the world. And it just, I guess her life, it has these such huge highs and lows of poverty and glamour. And she was such a genuinely talented woman, I think, that she was a proper, she was a real star of the theatre, and she's been entirely forgotten because of her status as being a mistress. She was unmarried, she had all of these children, she was known to be involved with this member of the royal family, so therefore her work is kind of delegitimized. And the injustice of that story just really, as a teenager, it really struck me. And as I went on, I started realizing she was not the only one. There are hundreds of women of her sort in the 1780s and 90s who were genuinely talented, were genuinely contributing to the world, but who have been so absolutely dismissed by history because of essentially their marital status, because we're able to boil them down to being whores, that therefore they contribute nothing valid. And it just kind of breaks my heart. I just wanted to know about these women and who they really were and what their actual personal value was. I think that's really lost. And I think with characters like Angelica Neal and the other women in the novel, I was really trying to reach like the human side of these people.
Yeah, and interestingly, without again giving too much away, in some way you resolve the pain, the grief, the disconcertion that you had, if that's a word, with Dora Jordan by giving Angelica Neal a different ending.
Yeah, my mum, I hadn't even thought of that until my mum read the book. And she was like, oh, I see she has a happy ending. Did you do that because of Mrs. Jordan? And actually, yeah, I think you get to the end of all these biographies and these women are shut out and dying alone. And I just, well, you know, no spoilers, but I really didn't have the heart to do that to all of my characters. It's so cruel and unfair. I felt like, at least in fiction, they deserve some triumphs sometimes.
Well, it is just a terrific read, just a marvelous book. The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. I've been speaking with the author, Imogen Hermes Gower, and thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been such a nice talk.
Imogen Hermes Gower. Find a link to an excerpt from her novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.